Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
President Bush is expected to announce plans tonight to send thousands of National Guard troops to the U.S.-Mexico border. The president will propose using the troops as a stopgap measure to give the Border Patrol time to increase its own forces. The move is seen as an attempt to satisfy the president's conservative base, which is demanding a crackdown on the country's estimated 11 million illegal immigrants. Joining us from Washington, D.C. with the latest on immigration reform is David Lightman, Washington Bureau Chief for the Hartford Courant. David, what is the president expected to say tonight about border security? How many troops is he expected to talk about?
Probably fewer than 10,000 National Guardsmen. There are about 400,000 members of the Guard around the country, so this would be a very small number. But even that small number is causing a lot of controversy.
Well, we understand, for instance, the president received a distressed phone call from Mexican President Vicente Fox, a close ally. He's concerned that the U.S. is militarizing the border. And there are, you know, some who are questioning, you know, is this setting up a DMZ within the U.S.? You know, first of all, how much of a strain is this putting on the relationship with Mexico?
Well, that's unclear right now. The president told President Fox that any military support would be administrative and logistical and would not come from the Army. Now, again, is that a fine distinction, too fine a distinction or not? It's a very tough call. That's number one. And number two, relations had already been strained with Mexico over the last few years. So it's tense.
Well, and how much strain would this be putting on the National Guard? It split the Republicans. Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist says it's a good idea, but Republican Senator Chuck Hagel says the 400,000-strong National Guard is already stretched too thin. And we've been hearing that from state governors.
Exactly. This is nothing new. This has been a cry from governors, gosh, going back last year, even the year before. One of their points is that the Guard troops are on their third and fourth tours of duty. They're worn out. That's the first point. Second point, governors say, what if there is an emergency in our state? I mean, governors in the western states, for example, worried about fire danger. Governors in the Gulf Coast states worried about a new hurricane season. They want to know, are we going to have the troops, the manpower, to go in there and take care of these emergencies? It's a real serious issue.
We remember what happened in Louisiana, where National Guard troops who were in Iraq almost revolted because they wanted to go home to their state. And here in Massachusetts, we have flooding disasters in both Massachusetts and New Hampshire, Connecticut. We're going to have more on that later in the program. So that's a point that's obviously going to be a contentious one. But in terms of legislation, the House has already passed a tough measure that would create a fence along the border and make illegal immigrants felons. As we know, the Senate picks up debate on a bill tonight that would create a guest worker program and put some of the 11 million undocumented immigrants that are already here on the path to legal status. How does this suggestion by the president tonight impact the politics of this issue?
Well, obviously, he's hoping it has a huge impact on the politics, because what he's trying to be is the president of all the people, not just the leader of his party, the leader of a faction. He's trying to say, look, as your president, I want to show that, you know, we welcome immigrants, we welcome these people, but we're also going to get tough. He has to do what he hasn't done, frankly, in years, and that is build consensus, play the middle, bring people together. Maybe this will work. Certainly the stage is set. The Senate's going to be in this debate all week and possibly next week. And there is a feeling, at least in the Senate, that they do want some consensus way of dealing with this problem.
So this might be a quid pro quo. In other words, I'll put National Guardsmen on the border if you pass my guest worker program?
They don't talk like that quite that way in Washington, but yes is a simple answer. He's hoping he's got to calm the conservatives. There's, as you said at the outset, there are a lot of people, particularly in his party, who want that border sealed. Look, the House in December, in its bill, passed legislation that would set up a 698-mile fence along key parts of the border, and that passed with a lot of support. And the Senate, I'm not sure, is going to go that route, but I'll bet you there are 45 of the 100 senators that would be willing to.
And quick question, David. What's the legality of guardsmen guarding the border as opposed to the military? What are any of those issues?
Again, it's a question of exactly what they can do, and that goes back to what the president and his advisors are saying. They can be there for administrative help, take some of the logistical burden off. That's why this whole argument about it being a DMZ doesn't necessarily wash. On the other hand, they're armed. They could be armed. So all that's yet to be worked out.
And that just raises the question, too. There are already hundreds of citizens on the border, the Minutemen, the people who have taken into their own hands to guard the border. Does this set up conflict between those citizens and guardsmen?
In theory, it does, although if ever there was a conflict, I think the government would win that one in a minute. But, boy, it sure has the makings of it.
David Lightman, Washington bureau chief of the Hartford Courant, speaking to us about the president's plan to send thousands of troops to secure the U.S.-Mexico border. He's expected to announce that plan tonight. David, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
And staying with the week ahead in Washington, two leading Republican senators are saying that General Michael Hayden's confirmation as CIA chief depends on how he answers questions about how the National Security Agency is spying on Americans. Hayden is the former head of the NSA. The agency has acknowledged that it is eavesdropping on international communications and collecting the phone records of domestic calls. But Hadley may not provide the answers lawmakers seek when proceedings start this Thursday. White House National Security Advisor Stephen Hadley said on CBS's Face the Nation yesterday that General Hayden has already answered lawmakers' questions about the surveillance.
The whole point of these programs is they are secret programs because if they become public, their value is attrited because then the bad guy knows what we're doing.
Well, joining us from Northampton, Massachusetts, is Christopher Pyle. He's professor of politics at Mount Holyoke College. His specialty is constitutional law and civil liberties. He's a former Army intelligence officer. And in 1970, he blew the whistle on military surveillance of Vietnam War-era protesters. And he later worked with the Congressional Church Committee investigating that spying. So we thought we'd prick his brain today on the current debate. And Professor Pyle, welcome.
Thank you.
Tell me, first of all, what was your response to the NSA programs, both of calls going overseas, the eavesdropping, and the millions of domestic records that are collected but not listened in on?
Well, the wiretapping is illegal. In fact, it's a crime. It's a felony punishable by up to 5 years in prison, and that's provided by Section 2511(2)(f) of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act of 1978. There's really no question about that, despite efforts by the administration to fuzz the issue. That law is very, very clear. There are no ambiguities. There are no exceptions.
Well, of course, the White House is saying they've had full legal review, and Hayden's saying that as well, but it is a secret program, so it is hard to get underneath this.
Well, you don't need a secret program once you know the basic facts, and the basic facts are they've been conducting extensive wiretapping without following the provisions of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, which require them to go to the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court for a special court order. They didn't do that. They've admitted they didn't do it. They've admitted to committing a felony.
This is the FISA court. And so that brings us to your background. And let's get to that. In 1970, as we said, you were the whistleblower. The work that you did in the year succeeding blowing that whistle led to the FISA court. So let's start with 1970. Who was the government spying on then, and why did you blow the whistle?
Well, the program that I learned about while serving in the armed forces was the U.S. Army's program of monitoring anti-war and civil rights protests. They had 1,500 agents working out of 300 offices coast to coast, watching every demonstration of 20 people or more. They had a huge warehouse full of files on civilian political activity and for computer data banks. And that clearly to me was unauthorized. It violated people's First Amendment rights. It violated people's privacy. And it was a colossal waste of taxpayers' money, since the military didn't need any of that information to carry out its domestic jobs.
Well, subsequently, your work with the Church Commission led to the secret FISA courts, as we said, the Freedom of Intelligence Surveillance Act, and it said that if NSA or the FBI wanted to spy on Americans domestically, they had to get a special warrant. Now, in the past decade, we understand thousands of those warrants have been requested, over 10,000, but only 4 turned down. So, in your view, did those courts work?
I don't think so, generally, but they do help to at least educate the Justice Department. They create a kind of bureaucratic constraint, and that's why the government had to go around it when they wanted to do massive surveillance, when they wanted to do data mining. What we haven't heard of from the president yet is what NSA was really doing. And from what I can tell from various reports, what NSA was really doing was not wiretapping suspected terrorists. It was conducting data mining on thousands upon thousands of telecommunications passing through the United States. It wasn't searching for the terrorist needle in the haystack. It was searching for the patterns of hay that fell on the floor in the course of the search.
Well, let's talk about people who defend that. For instance, I'm reading in the Weekly Standard, conservative publication, obviously, but Heather McDonald, writing in the Weekly Standard, says that's precisely the point. The data mining is taking trillions of pieces of information, phone numbers stripped of any personal information, and putting them in sort of a linkage to see what kind of pattern shows up. She said that, in fact, it's precisely the size of this data store that renders the image of individualized snooping absurd.
Well, it isn't individualized snooping, that's for sure. She's correct on that. Her other claims, I don't know how she knows that in any great detail. But the fact is that the government has no authority to do that. It has to get authority from the FISA court before it can do that sort of thing. It did not do that, and this is not government under law. In addition, on leaving the legal issues aside, the program's not working, and that's why they're stopping it. The program has been a colossal waste of $1.2 billion. The program's name is Operation Trailblazer. It was initiated in 1999 by General Hayden. It is a waste of money. The CIA, the FBI have both confirmed that. And that's why the president can now say we're not data mining.
Because, and that was the program that you had actually learned about, this Operation Trailblazer, prior to all this news coming out. Can you tell us more about that? I mean, and your thoughts when you learned about it?
Well, it's just a repetition of history, because in the 1950s and 60s, the National Security Agency had files on 70,000 Americans, including Dr. Martin Luther King and Dr. Benjamin Spock.
But I want to hold you up there. We have a couple minutes before the break, and we're going to continue our conversation after that. But, you know, some would say in the 60s and 70s, it became clear that the government was using spying to attack political enemies, whereas today the enemy is terrorism, and it's a different time.
The enemy is terrorism, but what is terrorism? The definitions of terrorism used by the domestic intelligence agencies are so broad as to be meaningless. They include Quakers down in Florida protesting the recruitment of military personnel from high schools.
And so in your opinion, these programs have not worked at all, cannot work at all?
Well, the massive data mining seems to be a waste of money and time, according to the people who are most acquainted with it.
Yeah.
And that doesn't surprise me. It's the Roman method of intelligence. It's like looking at the entrails of sheep, and it's about as effective.
Christopher Pyle, a former intelligence officer. He teaches constitutional law at Mount Holyoke College. He also blew the whistle on domestic spying in the 60s and 70s, rather, on the part of the U.S. government. When we come back, his thoughts for how should any kind of domestic intelligence be gathered. We'll have much more with Chris Pyle in a moment. Stay with us. More coming up here now. Agency's surveillance of Americans, issues that senators are demanding former NSA Chief General Michael Hayden address when he comes up for hearing this Thursday on his bid to become the next head of the CIA. We're talking to Christopher Pyle, professor of politics at Mount Holyoke College, a former Army intelligence officer and the whistleblower in the 70s on military surveillance of civilian politics then. Professor Pyle, I'm reminded yet again of the CIA's history when reading the New York Times yesterday. The agency was created to centralize intelligence because of the military's failure then to foresee the attack on Pearl Harbor. Now, the newspaper says that we've come full circle and the CIA no longer does what's called strategic intelligence, you know, big picture thinking. Do you agree? And how, you know, how should that be changed?
Well, these are enormously complex matters. There is some talk that all analytical capabilities would be removed from the CIA and sent upstairs to Negroponte's office. I don't think that's going to happen. What will probably happen is he'll try to move the analytical capabilities on counterterrorism upstairs one notch. This separates the collection people from the analysts. I don't think bureaucratically that's a particularly good idea. If you and I are doing research, we don't simply take the research that somebody brings into the office and treat it at face value. We want to talk to the sources. We want to find out who the informant was and what the credibility of that informant was. We want to go back and forth, until we can really assess the value of that piece of apparent information. And so dismembering the CIA does not make a whole lot of sense. We do need to integrate intelligence analysis and intelligence collection. The big scandal, however, and it pervades every intelligence agency, is the lack of language skills. This country has always been very poor at that. We're extremely provincial. When we invaded Afghanistan, we had only one certified translator of Pashto in the entire United States. If we're going to be a world power, we had better know some foreign languages. And if we're going to collect intelligence, particularly intelligence against terrorists who operate in foreign languages, we need operations in those languages, not operations here in the United States, in the English language, focused on phone records.
You're talking about the lack of human intelligence, and there's been a lot of criticism of that, but some would say the terrorists are here. We're reminded that some of the 9/11 attackers lived in Langley, where the CIA is headquartered. They worked out at the gym with agents. So is there any kind of way of gathering intelligence here in the U.S. that you would agree with outside of, as you said, human intelligence, talking to people?
Sure, and the most important single way is through walk-in informants. Mm-hmm. We need to encourage people who speak those languages, who live among us, to inform us of unusual activities in their communities. And unfortunately, when we rounded up 5,000 Muslim immigrants under John Ashcroft's reign, we alienated that community and shut off a potential, the most important potential single source we had. We also need to monitor some international communications. That's certainly true. But the scale at which this operation is going is a colossal waste of money. It is filling the system with so much noise, nobody would hear the signal if they could. And that has always been a problem, and that was a problem going back to Pearl Harbor.
Well, it was a problem.
Expanding the system does not make it more efficient.
It was a problem the day before 9/11. We're reminded as well, because there was information and it couldn't be found. It wasn't sifted through till the next day. But I want to ask you, why do you think more Americans don't agree with you when you say that, for instance, the NSA records gathering programs don't work? Some polls show a majority support the program, others slimmer support, 49%. Still higher than some people would think. Why do you think that is?
Well, if I were an electrician, I could probably show that most people wouldn't know how to wire a house.
You mean it's a lack of knowledge?
Of course.
Yeah. Because
no fault of theirs. We're all ignorant on various things. And it helps to know something about the intelligence agencies before you make a guess as to what the best way to handle it is. But one way to handle it is not to expand them.
Well,
there aren't that many terrorists.
Let's talk about the man at the center who's going to be questioned about this week, Michael Hayden. Some of his critics worry about the militarization of the CIA. That, first of all, what do you think?
Well, the CIA has always had military personnel, sometimes at the top, sometimes in second, third positions. I don't think that's a terribly important issue. I do worry about the more generalized militarization of the United States, including what your previous speaker was saying about putting troops on the border on the south. I think as this country gets used to military solutions for things, they lose a lot of sense of perspective and balance, and they end up having people in positions which are very sensitive and involve the enforcement of the law, essentially trained only to use force, and that's not a good thing to have.
Well, we want to point out, too, that General Hayden's supporters point to yesterday's New York Times report that after the 9/11 attacks, Vice President Dick Cheney pushed for even more surveillance of Americans, and it was General Hayden who objected, pushed back.
Yes, but he still ended up violating the law, didn't he?
I want to go to your comment, when we talked about why more Americans aren't aghast at this as they were in the 70s. Do you think that this is a different kind of America today? People expect to get spam from strangers in their email, to have someone hack into their computers, to have their information sold to companies, telephone information including. Do you think that this technology is part of what's eroding possible protest against these programs?
Yes, there is a piece of that. Part of it is cultural. It's the Britney Spears approach. Let it all hang out. Americans are much more candid about their lives than they ever were before. That's a piece of it. But much of it is the American public doesn't appreciate just how large and interconnected this domestic intelligence apparatus is. It now exceeds already the wildest imaginings of the KGB or the Gestapo. And it's not run by the KGB or the Gestapo or anybody like it. It's run by your friends and neighbors. But it is an enormous system processing enormous amounts of essentially irrelevant evidence. And that's very serious.
Christopher Pyle, a professor of politics at Mount Holyoke, a former Army intelligence officer and the whistleblower in the 70s on military surveillance of protesters back then. Professor, thank you so much. And I never thought we'd get Britney Spears into this conversation, but thank you. And we'll visit with you again.
Great. Thank you very much.
Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from WBUR Boston, where the program is produced.
And the divisions which remain. If we are to heal those divisions, then this must be a time to focus on what unites us.
Eileen Bell, Speaker of the Northern Ireland Assembly, speaking in Belfast today, as Catholic and Protestant lawmakers met for the first time in more than 3.5 years. Assembly members are trying to form a Catholic-Protestant power-sharing administration, the elusive goal of the now 8-year Good Friday Peace Accord that was supposed to bring the two sides together politically in the long-running conflict known as the Troubles. But the brutal killing last week of a Catholic boy by a Protestant gang stands as a reminder of the past that just won't seem to go away. Noel McAdam is political correspondent for the Belfast Telegraph. He covered today's session. The show of unity between Catholics and Protestant lawmakers was brief. It lasted just 1 hour. And Noel joins us now on the line from Belfast. Noel, first of all, the words we heard from Eileen Bell. We understand she was reading from a letter from the British.
That's right. She was reading from a letter from the British Secretary of State, Peter Hain, who, of course, actually controls what business this assembly will be able to do. This is not the same sort of assembly that was set up by the Good Friday Agreement. This is an assembly with one real task only, which is, as you said, to try to form a government.
Yeah, we understand the session was short. Because of the death of this 15-year-old boy last week, what happened to him and why has that, you know, affected this process?
You know, we are getting used to less violence in Northern Ireland than we used to have. So when something like the tragic death of Michael McElveen last week happens, and even though there's no apparent paramilitary involvement in that death, it still reminds us of where we have been here. There's no doubt that it was a brutal killing by Protestants of a young Catholic boy in a town which known as Ballymena, which is predominantly Protestant, but where Catholics have been demanding their rights, for example, to hold parades in recent years, and that has caused tensions in the town. There have been a number of attacks on Catholic youths in the last short while, but this one just resulted in the young man dying a few days after he was so brutally assaulted.
We understand he was beaten by a baseball bat, made his way home before dying. And we understand, though, that in the wake of his death, many of the Protestant leaders and clergy came forward and condemned the killing, which would seem like an advance. But we understand that it impacted the session today.
Many of the Protestant leaders immediately came forward, including the MP for the area, the DUP leader, the Reverend Ian Paisley, who apparently was the first to phone the family of the young man and pray with them down the telephone line, and they then expressly went public to invite him to his funeral, which is taking place later on this week. And I understand he also visited the family yesterday. So today, the Speaker, Eileen Bell, again reading from that letter, invited all the members of the Assembly to stand for a minute's silence in respect of the young man. And you could have heard a pin drop during that minute.
Well, but then we understand moments later they made their divisions part of the public record, signing their names into registration books, one for the British Protestant side of the house, the other for the smaller Irish Catholic side. You know, during the course of business, outside of that moment of silence, what did it feel like inside this assembly chamber?
Well, it was quite a subdued and quiet day. It was expected to be so. We have a royal visit here today from Prince Charles and his wife Camilla, so there were many of the members, including some nationalists who were heading for the garden party. So there wasn't a lot of time this morning, but they had this formality of signing the book and registering themselves as unionists, nationalists, or other, which took the best part of the hour.
Well, we'll remind ourselves of the main players here. There's Ian Paisley's Democratic Union Party, the DUP, the Unionists, and they want the Catholics, Sinn Féin, to declare that war is over. They also say they want Sinn Féin to repudiate criminal activity. Does it feel as if this process is going to go forward or get hung up on these demands?
Well, it's very difficult to judge just at this point in time. There's undoubted progress on the Catholic nationalist side. Peter Hain, in his letter today, did say that he understood that Republicans have said, in effect, the war is over, and that Gerry Adams and Martin McGuinness, the leaders of Sinn Féin, have effectively repudiated criminality along with the Provisional IRA in recent statements, and these are the demands which unionists have made. And nevertheless, unionists will probably wait to see the next report from the Independent Monitoring Commission, which monitors paramilitary activity, and if they give a clean bill of health to the Provisional IRA, then the DUP, Ian Paisley's party, says it will set in train a wider consultation with the unionist community that could be choreographed for the government's deadline, which is November the 24th.
And tell us about that. The British government has said what about that deadline?
Well, we've had so many deadlines in the past that they're not taken very seriously. But the British government and the Irish government also have put this date into legislation, and they insist that if there isn't an agreement on a devolved power-sharing administration by that date, they will pull the curtain down on the Assembly, and Britain, with some input from Ireland, will implement the Good Friday Agreement over the heads of local politicians.
What will that mean?
That will mean that the shutters come down, our local politicians don't get any salaries, don't get their allowances, and the two sovereign governments rule directly from London with some input from Dublin.
And so that would be it for the hopes of a Northern Ireland coalition?
Ostensibly, although, you know, we always, as I say, are quite cynical here and think that this deadline may be allowed somehow to be negotiated. If there was substantial progress by then, would they throw the whole thing up in the air if they actually hadn't reached a final deal? We don't know yet. Certainly, the government insists that they will not blink first.
So a lot at stake. Noel McAdam, a political correspondent for the Belfast Telegraph. We've been speaking to him about today's meeting of the Northern Ireland Assembly, the first in over 3.5 years. And as he said, the body faces a November deadline to reach agreement on a power-sharing government, or it's all over. Noel, thanks very much.
Bye night.
Well, still to come, if you're part Asian, what are you? We'll speak to a photographer who posed that question to people who call themselves Huppas. You're listening to Here and Now. Well, it has been unrelenting. to those of you suffering tornadoes or hurricanes, or to our listeners in Arizona suffering drought, it might not seem like a big deal. But for the past several days, most of New England, where we are, has been soaked by unrelenting rain. It's been described as the worst drenching the region has seen in 70 years, and forecasters expect it's only going to get worse. States of emergency have been declared in parts of Maine, New Hampshire, and Massachusetts, with many roads, particularly north of Boston, now looking more like rivers. In New Hampshire alone, almost 600 roads are closed, including some major thoroughfares. Schools been canceled in dozens of communities. Hundreds of people have been evacuated, while emergency workers continue to monitor swollen waterways. Well, joining us first on the line from Methuen, Massachusetts, here now is Fred Tice. Fred, Methuen's about 30 miles north of Boston, right on the Merrimack River, which is predicted to reach record high levels today. And we understand a nearby dam could be compromised. So what's happening there now?
Yeah, Robin, the dam is in downtown Methuen. It's a stone dam, and state officials had been working on it to repair it. It was long overdue for repairs. The mayor is concerned that the dam could break. They're looking at it right now. They'll make a decision later on as to whether they need to evacuate downtown Methuen. People are concerned. They're calling into City Hall and asking if they need to get out.
And we understand, you know, we have listeners across the country who are, perhaps heading this way because of all the graduations in the area. The ones this past weekend were completely soaked. But people in their homes were, we understand, jeopardized. Many people evacuated?
Yeah, there are about 100 or so people who have been evacuated. Streets along the river and some of those adjacent streets today, they were evacuating 100 units of an apartment building. Various cities along the Merrimack River are being evacuated. People are being evacuated from them. Here in Methuen, there's a Red Cross center at the local high school where they're taking people from this town and from the next town. And also in the next town of Lawrence, there has been a sewage treatment plant for the Greater Lawrence Sanitary District that is now discharging raw sewage into the river, and that's going to be a worry for several days.
We understand the National Guard also has been called out in different areas. That's here now, Fred Tice. Fred, thanks.
You're very welcome.
And now joining us in the studio with a look at what's happening around the region, here now is Martha Biebinger. And Martha, what other waterways besides the Merrimack River are being monitored?
There are at least two other waterways besides the Merrimack that have crested, meaning they've flowed into their floodplains, Robin. And there are about a dozen others that officials are monitoring. Many of the communities north of Boston along the New Hampshire border say that this is the worst flooding they've seen since a major hurricane hit here in 1938.
Mm-hmm. And we might remember last spring there were some poor people who had come up from Louisiana to escape the hurricane, and
right.
They were in a town in Taunton where there were also flooding issues,
mm-hmm.
and couldn't escape it. But what are emergency management officials doing to prepare for this year's water?
We have National Guard troops out, about 270 of them, who've been activated to help sandbag some of those dams to build them up. There isn't actually the threat, as you mentioned, we had last year of the dams breaching, but they want to be sure that the water doesn't spill over into areas like Fred was just talking about that are very heavily populated. The Guard troops are also helping with evacuations. About several thousand people have been evacuated from about a half dozen communities. And the troops are also helping direct traffic around flooded waterways that are inconveniencing people all across the state.
And again, we should say for people heading here for, graduations and all the other reasons you'd head to New England, there are parts of the area that are just fine. It's just very wet. But when might the rain let up?
Well, the rain has started to taper today. We might see another wave of rain coming in the next few days. But even if the rain does stop or at least stop flooding in the situation that it is right now, the rivers are just starting to crest. Mm-hmm. Tonight is the point at which we will really get a sense of how much damage might be caused by the rivers, depending on how far into the floodplain they spread.
Okay, so we will obviously be keeping an eye on that. But yet, do we know? I mean, it has been raining for a long time. Do they know? I mean, we hear possibly rain through the week.
It could be through Friday, right.
Okay. All righty then. Here now is Martha Biebinger, flooding throughout much of New England and keeping us up to date on that. And, not a sump pump in sight, all sold out at most stores. Martha, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now.
Thank you.
Papa, author and photographer Kip Fulbeck takes on the issue of multiracial identities. He's amassed photos of multiracial people along with their answers to his question, "What are you?"
I answer the question every day of my life, depending on the day itself, the location, my hair, or what I'm eating or doing. I get mistaken for Native American, Filipino, Hawaiian, African American, especially when my head is shaved, Mexican, Cuban, Middle Eastern, Indian. I've listened to a black woman chastise me for denying my African heritage, and a First Nations member pushed me to register my status. I'm greeted in Spanish, Farsi, and Pidgin, all the while being escorted to the various back tables in various Chinese restaurants and handed forks. The long hair, non-Gucci tattoo tables, the brown tables. On the street, interracial couples approach and scrutinize my face, wondering out loud what their future child might look like. And I learn to smile back when they do it. They're just curious, right?
That's Kip Fulbeck reading from his new book of photographs, Part Asian, 100% Hapa. And we welcome him from the studios of KQED in San Francisco. Kip, thanks so much.
Hey, Robin. Good to be here.
So what are you? I'm looking at your picture on the book flap. Full lips, long, straight, dark hair. Looks like brown eyes.
Well, when the question comes up, I usually default to the ethnicity thing, and I usually say I'm Hapa. And people then say, well, what does that mean?
Right.
I say it means part Asian, part Pacific Islander, part something else. And if they keep going, I'll say I'm Chinese, English, Irish, Welsh. What are you?
Right. And that brings us to what was going to be my second blunt question, Hapa. This is a word that we understand came from Hawaii.
Yeah, it's a Hawaiian word. It literally means half or portion. And prior to 1960, it was used in the phrase hapa haole for people that were part Hawaiian and part white. Later, it started to become people that are part Asian or Pacific Islander.
And when did you know you were a hapa?
I think I was told when I was about 4 or 5. I had some, you know, Chinese relatives that said, "You're hapa." And I said, "Okay."
Whatever that means. Well, and we explore what it means to the many people that you photographed and put in the book. Why did you do this? Why did you take on this project?
Well, I can answer it in some pretty theoretical ways, but the real reason is just I wanted to make the book that I wish I had around as a kid. I mean, for me growing up, I was born in 65, so I was born 2 years before all the laws went off the books that banned interracial marriages in this country.
Right.
So in some weird way, my birth is kind of illegal. And for me growing up, every ethnicity question I had, every job application or school form always made me pick one or the other, pick mom or dad. And I thought that was really crazy. So I thought I would make this book to let people tell who they were in their own words.
Let's take a look at some of the pictures. And by the way, they're on our website, here-now.org. And as we said, one side of the book has the full, beautiful pictures of people from the neck up, no adornments, no jewelry, no makeup, just staring straight at the camera. On the left side, the page has in their writing their own descriptions of themselves and their answer to your question. And I want to look at the first one on page 171. There's a little guy looking at us. Well, he's not a little boy.
Oh, that kid. Oh, yeah. I know. He's Filipino-Mexican-Irish. He's probably about 10 years old, and he writes down his statement, "I'm a very little boy in fifth grade that has no friends," or as he writes, "has no friends." And that's actually the only kid. I photographed over 1,000 people. He's the only kid I actually tried to intervene with what he wrote. I actually tried to, like, influence him. I said, "Look, you got it right. You've got one friend." And he's like, "I don't have any friends." And then it's funny, I did a show here in San Francisco. I had a gallery show, and a guy in his 40s came up to me and said, "That little kid that has no friends, I really feel it." I said, "Oh, I know it. We've all been that kid at some point." And the guy said, "Kid, I'm talking about now."
Well, and you talk about when you were a little kid, there was an exercise at one point where everybody had to go up and put a flag in their country of origin.
We had this map that went across the whole wall of the room, and everyone had their little thumbtacks with their initials. And, you know, we went up one by one and put our initials in these countries. And I watched the entire part of Western Europe get filled up. And then so it finally came to my turn. I went dead last. I went to England. I went to Ireland, plopped my flag in there, and then I had to walk what seemed like about 3 miles across this room to China and just stick it in there, and all these kids sort of snickered and laughed, and it really stuck with me.
Yeah. So here's your chance to perhaps, you know, make that book for all those little kids to see, you know, all the different faces that you've assembled and all the different flags. I'm looking now at page 55. Here's a woman who's Filipina, Norwegian, and Irish, but as she says, Norwegian blood really sucks the color out of everything.
Well, you know who that is, Robin?
No, who's that?
That's Linda Barry, the comic artist.
Oh, my gosh, so it is.
She does a lot of work in her book, 100 Demons, where she talks about growing up with the Filipino culture.
Yeah. And as she writes in her explanation, she says in family portraits, those who had the Norwegian background, and again, this was a Filipina family she grew up in, we look like neighbors who just dropped by for some really good food and beer.
Yeah, that's really funny.
What was the overall reaction from people you asked to pose?
unbelievably supportive. I never had to recruit. I went and shot around the country, over 1,000 people, and all I did was announce on the website and people would show up. I would do shoots where there would be 30, 40, 50 people at the door before I got there.
You know, I'm wondering, especially now in light of the country's conversation about immigrants, illegal and otherwise, you know, did you feel a sense of, you know, people wanting to claim this, who they are?
Well, we live in a country that really divides by race. I mean, our whole history is based, you know, on, you know, issues of slavery and Jim Crow laws and so forth. And we have this thing where we're always dividing and dividing and dividing. But if you're Hapa, you really don't have a place to fit in. I mean, it wasn't until the 2000 census that, you know, 6 years ago, where you could actually put down more than one box. Before that, we have millions of people that can't check more than one box. It's ridiculous.
Well, in fact, you did a reading just a few seconds ago about your experience. And you write that you could be questioned by some people about what they see in you, but at the same time maybe rejected by other people because of what they see in you. You were talking about how, you know, you're greeted in Spanish and Farsi, but escorted to back tables in Chinese restaurants. The brown tables, what's that?
Never Chinese enough in my family. I mean, I'm really dark. I'm a swimmer and surfer, and I'm covered in tattoos, and so I really don't fit a traditional sort of good Chinese boy stereotype, although I was pre-med at one point. I did do that for a while.
Now, you're the one saying that. I have to hasten to point out.
Everyone talks about, like, have you gone back to China? I've gone back to China many, many times, but people expect this to be some kind of Joy Luck Club thing where you go back and people will embrace you and take you to your ancestors' village and, oh, you're here, this is for you. And it's not like that at all.
No.
I mean, you go back there, I'm an American.
The reactions are just all across the board, and some very funny, some poignant, as we said, but some very funny. I'm looking at the little boy on page 31. He's Chinese and Danish. There's a problem there. Explain.
Well, he says, I'm part Chinese and part Danish. I don't usually tell people I'm Danish, though, because they think I'm a pastry. Which I thought was great because he's probably told that joke and his parents have probably told that joke his whole life, but I'd never heard that. And what I thought was great about, you know, doing the project for me is I learned so much about people because everyone gets to have their own statement. And so even though that's something that's old to him, it was really fresh and new to me.
Kip, I'm looking right now at a picture of a little Cuban Japanese Jewish girl on page 40. But some of these people, and we've been really poring over them, you can't see any Asian in them.
Yeah, she's really interesting. Her she's Kwapa, so she's a quarter. Her father is actually in the book as well. He's Hapa, and so she's really one quarter Japanese. And there's people that are quarter Japanese that, you know, phenotypically it looks really strong, but she you would never tell.
By the way, what's phenotypically?
Phenotypically is the way you actually look physically on the outside.
Another subject on page 153 says to you, shouldn't you be asking my name first? She's Chinese and African American. What should we do, you who are Hapa? Is it insulting for people to ask?
I'm a little different than most people I've talked to in the book. Most people get very offended by it. I actually don't have a problem with what are you, so long as people are treating it with respect and so long as they are willing to answer the question themselves. And so when I have someone run up across the street and say, like, oh, what are you First Nations? What tribe are you? And I say, well, I'm Chinese, English, Irish. And so what are you? Oh, I'm just white. And they walk away. I say, hold on a second. Let's have a little chat here, because what does just white mean?
You tell me what you are, too.
Yeah. As long as it's a discussion and people are willing to sort of give of themselves, I think it's a great thing. I think we need to talk about this.
Kip Fulbeck, his new book, Part Asian, 100% Hapa. It's a collection of photos of multiracial people and their thoughts about being multiracial. Kip, thanks so much for telling us more about it.
Thank you, Robin. I appreciate you having me here.
Close your eyes. Have no fear. The monster's gone. He's on the run and your daddy's here. Beautiful, beautiful, beautiful.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now.